Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we look at the year in architecture in San Francisco. As the city's building boom continues, planners are busier than ever. Cranes blanket the skyline, and some San Francisco neighborhoods are changing so rapidly they are almost unrecognizable. A walk through parts of the South of Market area, for instance, reveals this change. What was once a sleepy mix of light industrial small businesses and warehouses is now characterized by crowded sidewalks, new construction, and a renewed urban energy. Development is a complicated business in San Francisco, though, with multiple regulations in place that are designed to address the city's challenges. Given the regulatory constraints on architects, can any of these new buildings be considered architecturally significant? Is there an architectural statement that our city, with its famous bridges, significant museums, and iconic Transamerica Tower, is missing? And how is all this new construction fitting in with San Francisco's unique architectural character? While we'll focus on aesthetics and form and function on our architectural journey this evening, we'll also try to discuss how there can be creative solutions brought by architecture to chronic social conditions like lack of affordable housing and homelessness. To discuss all this and more, I am pleased to be joined in the studio by two architects. First is Lisa Iwamoto. She's principal of Iwamoto Scott Architects and professor of architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley. Her significant projects include the development of the existing San Francisco Tennis Club at 88 Bluxom Street and the interiors of the Pinterest headquarters. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Also joined in the studio by Stanley Sadowitz. He is principal of Natoma Architects and emeritus professor of architecture at the College of Urban Design at UC Berkeley. Significant projects that he's been involved with include the multifamily 8 Octavia Street at the corner of Octavia and Market Streets and the apartment building at 1080 Sutter Street. Welcome, Stanley.
Thank you.
And by phone, we're grateful that John King, who's a little under the weather, has decided to join us by phone tonight. Thanks so much, John, for making the time. He's urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's also author of the Cityscape series, the most recent of which is Cityscapes 2, Reading the Architecture of San Francisco. Welcome, John.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks, and welcome back to the program. We had you here a couple years ago. And so, of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. The number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website. You can also tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, John King, I'm going to start with you. Referencing your articles in the Chronicle, specifically your look at the top buildings of San Francisco of 2016. Why don't you take us through some of those?
It's a funny year, as you mentioned in the introduction, that so much is being built right now and lots of it is getting done, but for the most part, there's still a sense that the important buildings are on the way. But I think that in terms of what really counts architecturally in 2016, obviously the first building is SF MoMA, you know, done by Snohetto with the assistance of local firm EHDD. And, you know, that doubled the size, totally changed the way the South of Market just looks and feels. And it's this real interesting building that on the one hand has international aspirations in architecture, but on the other hand, the idea is to really knit the museum into the neighborhood in a way that the old Mario Botta building didn't do. And that is kind of a common thread through a lot of the buildings in San Francisco now. Whether it's planners or whether it's some of the good architects, there's a real thought, how do we tie things together? Because increasingly this is a pedestrian city. A city people want to navigate out of a car, out of one destination to another. It's the context. So it's interesting. You've got SF MoMA, which we can talk about later. I'm sure Lisa and Stanley have thoughts on that. But then down at the corner, you have the LinkedIn Tower, which is at 222 2nd Street at 2nd and Howard. And it's a fascinating building almost rhetorically because it's this big, I think, 26 or 32-story stack of big squat black boxes covered in shingled gray glass panels kind of shingled in overlapping patterns that shift at different floors. And to me, it really is a fascinating work of architecture. It's extremely well done. The designer was Thomas Pfeiffer from New York, assisted by Gensler here in San Francisco. Extremely well done, and purely as a study of how can you package office space in the second decade of the 21st century, it's really interesting. It has a very strong public space on the ground floor that's very much open to the public. You've got 20-foot high doors that slide open, but it feels totally wrong for San Francisco. It's a big black box on Second Street, which is all about masonry buildings, and then Howard Street, which SF MoMA backs onto. The whole idea is, again, the masonry texture and how do you fold into the city, and this is a building that's proud to stand aloof. And it's a fascinating building because it actually does work well on its own terms, but it doesn't work well in the larger argument. But I think in terms of other interesting buildings, we continue to see some of the best infill buildings tend to be affordable housing buildings. There's a real nice new one being completed down in Mission Bay by David Baker, so technically that's 2017. But you've got things like that. You've got all the towers on Rincon Hill, none of which are great. I think 299 Fremont works as a piece of urbanism, just it's got a good ground. It kind of meets the skyline without just being another big glass box. But it's tricky. For all the changes, it's still not architecture and buildings as much as every old gas station on Valencia Street is being filled with a five-story block of condos. The Hunters Point Shipyard now has housing beginning to fill in on the heights, and the idea is not to look like Mission Bay, but to have more of a neighborhood feel. Mission Bay, meanwhile, is filling in, and the Warriors Arena is under construction. I mean, it's... And then, even more than SF MoMA, I think, and I'll quit talking in just a sec, the most powerful architectural statement of 2016, and it continues, is the Salesforce Tower at First and Mission Street by the new Transbay Transit Center. It's still under construction, but it is now the tallest structure in San Francisco. It's about 1,000 feet high, and it's not done rising. It's got another 70 feet or 100 feet to go. And that building has just reshifted the scale of the skyline and just emphasized how much of San Francisco now is this move south, this kind of gravitational creep south of Market Street. You know, so in terms of just pure architecture, I mean, there are some great little buildings in Hayes Valley. Stanley's was from 2015. 2016, Ann Fougeron had a real nice one open, things like that. But it definitely is still a work in progress. The cranes are still there, and the construction dust is still in the air.
So with that introduction, let me turn to our two in-studio guests, Lisa Iwamoto and Stanley Sadowitz. What would you say about John's characterization of the buildings of 2016?
You know, I think for me, one of the buildings that John left out and is my favorite is actually the Apple Store by Norman Foster. And I think despite it being a fairly small building, it's an actual real work of architecture at every level and a complete gem. I think the way it reconfigures the idea of retail as almost like an outdoor market with the big glass sliding doors, and the way it actually presents the objects that it's selling, which are these enormously powerful and miniature, really beautiful pieces, which are the Apple products, is quite brilliant. It's, you know, you inside there's trees, you can feel nature, and these things are paraded and stand up with the power that they have on their own to be in the world. And, you know, I think at every level it's just a really brilliant execution. It's a flawless piece of architecture. So to me, of all the buildings, you know, that were built in 2016, I would say that as a work of architecture stands out as complete and the best.
I think it's a really tricky proposition to build a signature building in San Francisco for a number of reasons. I think one is that San Francisco is much more about the streetscape than it is about having something stand out. I think the other thing that we have to deal with is what California works on in its entirety, which is Title 24 and the energy code. So when I think about the LinkedIn building, for example, I think John was really accurate in saying that it is a really well-executed building. It's a challenge, though, because...
That's the one at 222 Second?
That's a link, yeah, that's okay. 222 Second Street.
Okay.
Their attitude, it's a pretty abstract and austere building, and I think that initially the attitude was that it would be really transparent, and I think it would have really recast the building and the landscape of the city and been really beautiful. I don't think it's not beautiful now, but the dark color of the glass is really because of the energy requirements for the project, and I think it's that it becomes this dark monolith in the city that makes it feel kind of un-San Franciscan. On the other hand, I think it works really great at the street level, and I do really appreciate the kind of attempt to make the minimal facade three-dimensional through the way that the glass shingles. And so that's just one example of the kinds of things that architects work with and have to negotiate with to make buildings in the city.
I agree with Lisa about, you know, the street level of that building and the lobby, which in a way has a similar kind of characteristic to the Apple Store in that it completely dissolves and sort of turns the building into the street. And, I mean, I love that as a way to sort of transform the idea of entering a corporate building. So I find that very successful. Again, I agree with John about the color, you know, and I'm always sort of lamenting the loss of the beautiful white Mediterranean San Francisco that we know from images when we come across the Golden Gate Bridge or from the photographs of the city. I mean, for me, that does capture a very particular quality of this place. So the darkness is something that I think, you know, is out of character.
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily Mediterranean, but the SF MoMA extension is white. Say more about what you think about that structure.
I think that's another project that has to negotiate a couple of complex things. One is the attachment, physical connection to the Mario Botta original building. The other is recreating a new entry on a different street. I think they did a really good job urbanistically of having that courtyard and the passage through and the whole public space on the first floor with the Richard Serra sculpture. I think they created an interesting facade. I'm not sure about the connection to the Mario Botta building and taking out the interior stair of the original project, which makes the circulation through the new building a little bit disconnected, I would say. I mean, I think that SF MoMA, that's a project that wants to be a signature piece.
I think that's really true, and this is John again, and it's fascinating with SF MoMA is that it does want to be a signature building. Obviously, the museum wants that, and the architects want that. And there was a lot of talk about from the architects from outside, Greg Dykers of Snohead and all, of the luminous quality of San Francisco, the fogginess of San Francisco, and wanting a building that kind of captured that. And it is tricky to make things, you can kind of render things or you can conceive things, but then you have to actually build it. Lisa was very smart talking about Title 24, and one of the things that has come to really irritate me about SF MoMA...
Can you say more about what Title 24 is?
Oh, yes, where you have to have... Essentially, the building has to kind of, Lisa or Stanley can explain it better, but just the building has to have things to keep down energy use, keep down heat gain, and essentially glass has to be reflective in some way just to kind of try and put fewer energy demands on the building inside. It's very complicated mathematically, but it's interesting with SF MoMA. The idea is this ground floor that opens to the street, and or not physically opens, but visually opens to the street. There's the Richard Serra sculpture inside, really making the building part of the public realm in a way that Botta's brick castle wasn't. However, the glass, I don't know if it was Title 24, if it was just kind of missing details, it's kind of a reflective glass, so if you walk by it most times of the day, you can barely see anything inside it from the sidewalk. You know, it's not like the LinkedIn building where it opens up, or there's a nice new Davis Art Museum that,
Florian Eidenberg. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, and Bolin Cywinski helped on that. And it is beautiful glass that genuinely does dissolve. They did all the mathematical formulas so that with the main entry glass, it's ultra-low iron, it's totally see-through, it's like the building just disappears. And if you had that kind of thing on the ground floor of SF MoMA, I think it would be different.
A lot of the effort, on the exterior of SF MoMA is on that east-facing facade, which is basically what's typically a party wall. And I think, you know, that the sort of street and the facades that really could have more presence got less attention. The thing for me about, the difference between the Apple Store and the way it treats its products and the SF MoMA and the way it treats its collection is it's got a very, the Fisher collection is a very specific type of modern art. And I don't really see the connection between the architecture and the art. I mean, I think the architecture is from, it's part of a contemporary and current sort of set of interests, but it doesn't really reflect the type of art, which is about much more rigorous and pure and conceptual sorts of ideas than the sort of formality of the kind of the wall that is so sort of carefully detailed and attended to,
sculpted.
That's a great point. The Apple building is really amazing, just as a pure distillation of architecture and symbolism. Especially when the doors work, which they're working again, so that's good.
So to reach back a little into 2016 and to our current year for things to come, how about the Trans Bay Center? Some of it was unveiled in 2016. You want to walk us through that one, John?
Sure. I think this is one where we might kind of all differ. The Trans Bay Center, again, a work in progress. It's supposed to open at the end of the year, the first phase, the above-ground bus area. It extends nearly three blocks, almost 2nd Street, all the way to Beale Street, and it's between Mission and Howard, and so you've got these undulating walls that go for a quarter of a mile. It's kind of perforated white-painted aluminum with speckles in it and things, and it's like a drape perched above the alleyways, which are tended to very much function as pedestrian thoroughfares and very pedestrian-friendly active spaces. It just drapes across, it jumps over First Street, jumps over Fremont Street, and strictly as a work of architecture, it's way too much, and I think some people stop there, and, you know, more power to them. To me, what I kind of like about it is that this is a building you're never going to see all at once or anything unless you're walking down an alley really thinking about it. You're going to get glimpses of it between other buildings on the ground. And that becomes a good identifier that here's this building, there's the transit building, there's the transit building, there's the transit building. And it will be topped by a rooftop park. So 70 feet up, you'll be seeing large trees and things like that. So it becomes almost like a new topographical presence within the South of Market area.
Lisa and Stanley, your take on it?
I think a lot of things about that project have yet to be revealed. And one of the primary ones would be the quality of the landscape of the elevated park. So the other kind of elevated park that I think we might all, or many of us would be familiar with, is the High Line in New York. And that is, you know, just so hugely successful. It's successful because of the landscape and the social space which is created on the High Line. And then also it's becoming even more successful because of the way the buildings are now facing onto it and opening up onto it in some ways. So the Transbay Center doesn't have that opportunity as much. There's a couple buildings that opened up onto it, one being the Salesforce Tower, of course. But it seems like over time, more buildings, which had were initially designed not to face onto this fantastic park elevated 70 feet in the air, will have an opportunity to become redesigned to be able to do that. And so I think it's a longer range project than just what we're going to see when, you know, at the grand opening.
Stanley.
The actual presence of this sort of white perforated, almost like, you know, it's like a doily, is very sort of breathtaking. I mean, I must say the first time I saw it, it just it really shocked me. But I think John pointed out that it's always seen in fragments, and in that sense, it's a lot, but it's not overbearing, because you do identify it as this important kind of connective piece in the city.
How does it compare to, for what lack of a better term, the skin of the De Young in your minds?
The skin of the De Young, well, the era was different in which it was done. So the skin of the De Young, that's something that I teach in my class, for example, which is on digital fabrication methods, and we've kind of moved out of that era because that's become a very commonplace thing. But that was really innovative at the time. The way that they punched it, the way that they dimpled it and embossed that surface. It's also a surface that I think the idea of weathering was very much an attitude with how it would sit into the park and become patinaed over time. I think the Transbay, it's more of a decorative surface, which I'm not using that in a pejorative way at all. I think that that's what that surface wants to be. It wants to be white because it's a slice through the city. And while you don't see it all at once, you can put the pieces together mentally. I think it's similar in that it's perforated, but it's also really different because of the context.
I think the interesting thing about the De Young was that it was actually imagery from the park itself. It's almost like nature that was pixelated and transformed into this surface. And the thing about the Transbay is that it's very disconnected from its context. It's just a new imposed object, but it has no relation to the surrounds in any particular way.
John?
Oh, I think both of the points are real good. I mean, one difference, I mean, if you were to take the Transbay Transit Center and drop it into Golden Gate Park, it would look kind of ridiculous. It would just, the sameness would really wear you down. The De Young, the use of metal, you know, as Lisa said, it was innovative at the time. The weathering isn't happen. That's one of these things where maybe architecture's wish doesn't get granted in our lifetimes. But it is, you're starting to see hints of it. But it's much more, that building and the metal is a part of this, is much more of a shifting presence that thinks about how you read it. Like the tower, it looks so different from every other angle that it becomes a piece of artwork in itself, and not an iconic piece of artwork as much as just this odd presence. And the skin, even though the skin hasn't weathered, what strikes me is when the building is like kind of the corner of your eye, say you're at the Academy of Science and it's just back there, it almost has a geological feel. It feels like an outcrop or something. You don't think, oh, what's that big metal thing? It's almost like this natural feature. I think that the Transbay Transit Center will work well for the scale where it is, just because even now if you go down to Natoma or something and look during the day, the ripples, the way they catch the shadows, keeps it from being too monotonous. But there is a real sameness by design to the Transbay Transit Center. And the De Young is this big, massive building that is also remarkably subtle.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. Our guest tonight discussing San Francisco's architectural gems, or perhaps not, from 2016, and looking forward to the current year, are John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. We have Lisa Iwamoto. She's principal of Iwamoto Scott Architects and professor of architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley. And Stanley Sadowitz, principal of Natoma Architects and emeritus professor of architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments. Is there a new building that you wanted to ask our panel about, or tell us about what you thought about some of the buildings that our panelists highlighted in their initial comments? What do you think is San Francisco's most significant new development that's coming? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So I wanted to come back to something that all of you referenced at one point or another, which is how does a new piece, a new building, fit in, knit in to its local ecosystem? You could also speak of it sort of about the ecosystem at large in terms of the city. We're talking about a very specific part of the city, right? The eastern part, and then there, and then the south of Market part in particular. Sounds like we're in some cases doing better and in some cases not. What should we be doing when it comes to conceiving a project and thinking about how it sits within the buildings around it, noting that perhaps those buildings may also change one day? But what's the role of an architect in that aspect of design? Stanley?
The context, I think, is always a critical starting point. You know, the neighbors, I mean, the actual site itself, but then the surrounds, and then, you know, even the broader context of the city. And San Francisco has a very particular sort of climate and geography and character that's developed over a long time. And I think finding ways to constantly restate that unique character of the city, but in different ways, not imitating the way it's been said before, is what's important. You know, I think, for example, you know, we see a lot of like curtain wall sort of glass wrapped buildings now, but if you look at the older San Francisco building types, they were very beautiful, tall housing projects built on the hills, like in the Venice corridor, sort of almost wedding cakey white, very ornate. I mean, we have many things to learn from and work out of in our city in sort of moving it forward, instead of just sort of this generic kind of modern architecture that you can find in, you know, San Diego or Tucson or. So, I mean, I feel like the character of the city exists, and what we have to do is keep reiterating that character in the work.
And how, either you, Lisa, or John, how would you describe what that character is?
It's really tough, and I'm going to let Lisa talk, because she's been wrestling with this, the city of San Francisco, the planning department, is putting together urban design guidelines. But it's so difficult in San Francisco because the character is very distinctive, but it's very hard to define. You know, this is not a city like Boston where you go downtown and it's so strongly a masonry city that there's a real context there. You look at San Francisco and a neighborhood like the Mission or South of Market or Dog Patch, you get this real jumble of buildings. And the context people look at are the buildings they like best. And so it's tricky because a lot of buildings in San Francisco tend to look pretty much alike because planners say we want a tall ground floor for storefronts, which is a great idea. And we want kind of a bay pattern. We don't want fake Victorian bays, but we do want, you know, kind of rhythmic bay pattern, and we have a height limit, and we want for you to pull from these palettes of materials. We want buildings of our own time, but not stand out, not buildings that stand by themselves. And so you start to get this real odd kind of a lot of developers hire a lot of architects who just do good enough to get through the punch list and get the project approved. And so this real sameness kicks in. And it's, as Stanley was saying, it's true of places way beyond San Francisco, but the stakes are higher here.
So, there's a
difference between good urbanism and good architecture or good buildings.
And what does that mean?
Well, let me explain. So, you know, good urbanism has to do with meeting the street edge or creating the kind of urban room where one is part of the public space and public experience, has a level of comfort and boundaries and levels of boundaries or layers between inside and outside that make sense. And so it's not ambiguous, for example, where public ends and private begins. And then there's good architecture, which should always be good urbanistically, but doesn't necessarily need to follow a language which matches or is necessarily even consistent or even fits in with the surrounds. So I think one of the architect's responsibilities is to figure out how much fitting in is desirable and how much not fitting in is desirable. So just fitting in doesn't make good architecture. It actually often makes bad architecture. Fitting in urbanistically, yes. But in terms of language, I mean, we're in the 21st century, and it's important that architects design buildings which speak to their era as well as to their city.
But I do think...
I don't know, did we lose John there? Okay, we'll get John back on the line. Stanley, go ahead.
I do think that fitting in doesn't necessarily mean imitating. It's about a dialogue, and it's about translation. It's about condensation. It's about establishing some set of relationships. But it's obviously pointless, and nobody encourages imitating the context. But it is about, you know, and I think this is where perhaps, you know, the idea of trying to make rules about design, which is what the planning department have tried to do, actually can only accomplish a certain amount, because the next part, which is what changes from urbanism to architecture, is about a kind of inspiration and about something new. And, you know, there's no way for a planning department to actually make that happen. It has to come out of good architecture.
So, Lisa, can you say more about these urban guidelines, design guidelines that John and Stanley were just referencing?
Yeah, I think Stanley's probably seen them as well, but the planning department is coming out with a set of new urban design guidelines, which I have to say are riding the line in a good way, which, because it's very challenging, between having some prescriptive qualities so that buildings, you know, things that are getting built aren't terrible, as well as trying to allow for some leeway for architects to be able to have some creativity and imagination in their work. So I'm not sure how they'll ultimately get implemented and executed, but the types of illustrations in them show both historic work as well as contemporary work. They are written in such a way that asks for some consistency, but again, as Stanley was saying, not imitation. So, you know, I think that it seems like a good step, I suppose.
And why have these at all?
Have urban design guidelines? Because I think John and Stanley already mentioned it, which is, as in any profession, there are good architects and there are less good architects. There are people who are designing buildings who aren't architects at all, and that's to say that they don't design well. Many builders design excellent buildings. But, you know, there wants to be some kind of baseline, I suppose, for the city to ensure a certain level of urban responsibility and architectural integrity.
And who gets to decide what actually fits? Is it literally a committee that sits down and says, okay, this is how you've ticked off these 15-20 elements or whatever it would be?
There's a group in the planning department called UDAT, which is the Urban Design Advisory Team, who basically are the kind of aesthetic judges of the rightful fit or not of new work. And they're quite prescriptive in their recommendations for, you know, how they would like to see buildings develop. So they act as a committee that essentially give guidance to the architects on how they feel that their buildings should develop.
And we have John back on the line, I hear.
Yes. I don't know if anyone mentioned, but to pick up on Lisa's point about urbanism versus architecture, if a listener wants a real simple idea of what she's talking about, go down Market Street, kind of in the upper market area near the Castro. There are about at least half a dozen new residential buildings from the last 5 years, all built since the neighborhood was rezoned. For the most part, they're very well-planned buildings. They do all the right urbanistic things. Most of them are very much checklist architecture. A few of them are downright bad buildings. A few of them are pretty good. It's the kind of thing where they're making the planning committee happy. Everything's fitting together, but then when things get built, they don't have that kind of almost spiritual richness that even matter-of-fact older buildings do.
And so are the guidelines attempting to try to correct for this?
No, that's what the guidelines do.
I see.
I don't know. I'm not sure. That might sometimes be the case, but I think it's also just that I think that the clients and developers hiring architects to do buildings in the city should hire really good architects.
Okay.
I agree.
Yeah. Do you disagree, Stanley?
No, absolutely. Okay. I think ultimately, you know, there is a sort of element of architecture which is pretty rarefied. And, you know, it's not that it isn't recognized, but it's not on every street corner and not everybody does it.
Again, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're speaking with Stanley Sadowitz, Emeritus Professor of Architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley, Lisa Iwamoto, Professor of Architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley, and John King, Urban Design Critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Once again, the number to dial to join our conversation, 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. We had a caller who did not remain on the line, Richard from Berkeley. He wanted to know what's going on with the Millennium Tower. Any updates, John?
Well, it's still there. It hasn't tipped all the way over yet. I get asked more about the Millennium Tower than any building in San Francisco these days. I'm sure everyone knows this is the one that
It took us 39 minutes to get there.
It's the one that sunk about 18 inches, and it also has tilted about 6 inches, which towers are not supposed to do. You believe it or not, towers are expected to sink a bit, but they're expected to sink 6 inches or so, find their place, and stop sinking, you know, just settle into place. The developers have done a big test that say the building is stable, and the condo buyers have their own tests going on because they're, you know, there are a billion lawsuits right now.
Wow. All right. We have a caller, Michael from San Francisco. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hello. I'm basically calling to question or raise the point. My understanding is that the Transbay Center, the center of the Transbay Center, is supposed to be a, I guess, I don't know if the word is multimodal, but it's a regional transit center for, I guess, existing AC Transit or East Bay buses, and then eventually a high-speed rail, and maybe also eventually the electrified Caltrain. So if the high-speed rail doesn't happen, does anyone know, would the electrified Caltrain still go there, or is this going to be a transit center with just buses?
Thanks so much, Michael. I'll answer that, John. It's a huge, you know, basically what's going to open at the end of the year is a glorified bus station, you know, the world's most expensive bus station. Underground is where everything should come in. There's actually a big box that has been built underground for $400 million federal stimulus money going back to 2009. That's where the trains will arrive. And it's tough. You've got a Republican administration that doesn't want to do California any favors. You've got Republican congresspeople in California who are happy to take a whack at it because they see it as Jerry Brown's project. And it's tough because at this point, the feds have just scratched a $640 million grant that was to really allow the Caltrain electrification that is key to that. But that was being planned before the high-speed rail ever came into being. So this whole thing is going to be a political saga for the next few years. My hope is just that when all the dust settles, it'll be like the Golden Gate Bridge that got built or BART that got built, and then people say, how could we live without this? But it's scary because in the politics of 21st century California and America, there are many ways to broadside something that is big and expensive.
And we have a history of doing that for ourselves, let alone having the federal government interfere.
Yes.
Just thinking of that Octavia Boulevard. How long did it take to get that, right?
Yes. So
I want to shift gears. As I mentioned in the introduction, you know, architecture is we could go on talking about aesthetics and function and how to marry those. And I want to talk about the larger conversations about housing affordability and homelessness, and what role does architecture or do architects play? Do they have a duty to kind of help to shape solutions, or can they, given that they sort of are brought to a project once it's already been conceived? Help us understand that, whether there's a dialogue there.
The medium that we work with is certainly involved with problems about affordability. And there are ways, I think, through design where, by managing resources, we have the ability to produce economies. But in some ways, architecture is a fairly blunt tool to solve these political and social problems. But we're in the midst of them anyway. You know, I think one of the programs that we've sort of pioneered in this city is the affordable percentage of market rate products. And it's a very successful way, I think, to produce low-income housing without stigmatizing it and integrate it with, you know, the general kind of development of the city. The problem that I see with the way that it's implemented now is who bears the cost of that. And although, you know, the politicians seem to think that it's the developers who are contributing, it's actually the market itself that subsidizes the housing. So in the new buildings that I've built, for example, where there would be, say, 14% of below market rate units, which sell below the cost of what it costs to actually produce them, the buyers, and often first time home buyers who buying the other units in the building, you know, they are the ones that are actually ending up subsidizing the housing, which seems a little unfair, and that's why our market has been pushed so high in the production. And I think a fairer way would be to have a broader kind of contribution from property taxes, from everyone who owns houses, for example, rather than from new buyers who are paying.
Part of new construction specifically. Yeah.
John? I mean, what I've seen with architects, there is the really idealistic creative side of an architect who thinks about how can we reshape the unit of housing to make things more affordable. Unfortunately, a lot of what I've seen with that is that you'll have architects who think, how can we kind of reassemble the puzzle to build multifamily housing that costs less money? You know, that can go on the market for less, be purchased for less. And they'll draw things up, but they really run up against regulations and the basic zoning and planning of the city. Theoretically, you could change that, but then once it gets into the political mix, it often gets blocked by people who see, well, this is the camel's nose or something like that. So that's been frustrating. I know a lot of very creative architects who have ideas that can't pursue them.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, well, for instance, and I hate to say it, I'm forgetting the architect's name at this point, but there's one real good architect who has thought a lot about how do you kind of design new multifamily buildings that would be almost like, not aesthetically, but like that big old mansion that got cut up to 10 apartments at some point. You know, all the people in the, you know, you've got all these little rooms in that big old house in Noe Valley. Everyone uses the same kitchen. Everyone uses the two bathrooms and things. How could you design multifamily things where maybe there's just one kitchen per floor? And so maybe there's just a real bare bathroom within each unit, but then, you know, the larger things on each floor.
Well, that sounds like co-housing.
Yeah.
But co-housing, but more things that the market could build and could move more rapidly. Because co-housing is a wonderful thing, but it tends to be very much you get one in this city and one in that city.
But that kind of group housing is actually being designed and will be built. And I do think they are really amazing solutions to the problems that we face of housing shortage, where resources are, like, everyone has a kitchen and no one uses them. So why not sort of find better forms to actually produce things that are really resourceful?
And I mean, go ahead, Lisa.
I was saying, other cities are successful at creating new models. And, John, I completely agree with you that the creativity on the architect side, and I mean, it's a fascinating and super interesting problem about how to make houses more affordable or housing more affordable through the way they puzzle together, through the way they engage infrastructure, through their size. And cities like L.A. have the small lots kind of development where they are on maybe 750 square foot lots, single family residences or duplexes or triplexes even. New York has a micro unit project where they're building condominiums that are, you know, 500 square feet or under. And it does seem like there's certainly room for that in San Francisco. One other area that I feel like to add more units to the market and the question of affordability is because it's very difficult to add on in an incremental way to the housing stock which currently exists in San Francisco. And I'm not talking about the large multifamily projects, but more about everyone's home. And, you know, to be able to add on, I believe now, you know, people can add on an additional dwelling unit to their existing residences, but it's really difficult to get that through planning, not because of planning itself, but because of the really public and neighborhood involved process there. So there's a resistance in a way to densifying the single family residential stock in neighborhoods of the city, but it certainly seems like a really viable solution to the affordable housing crisis that we have.
In the same way that there were efforts and the local chapter of the American Institute of Architects was real involved, how could we allow extra height in commercial strips and residential neighborhoods to fold in some housing, and that just ran into total buzzsaws from the left and the neighborhood groups, and basically kind of died last year. It's being resurrected. The one thing I want to say real quick is to give architects credit. The other thing architects can do is make affordable housing projects really good places to live that are real assets to their neighborhood. And mm-hmm. San Francisco has a stronger track record than any city going back 20 or 30 years now at 100% affordable housing, often by nonprofit developers, that looks better than just about anything around it built by the market.
That's because it has better budgets. Often.
That's true. That's absolutely true, and it has political cover.
Right.
But the architects, you know, could also do a not very good job. So
So let's do a sort of a lightning round. For if you had one regulation that you wanted to change, what would it be? Give you like 10 seconds to think about it.
I would just get rid of the whole lot.
I think it'd be great to have some as-of-right zoning. So if you're fitting in a zoning envelope, whatever that zoning envelope may be, that your project can be approved.
Say a little bit more about that. I'm sorry. You said that really quickly.
The as-of-right zoning. My regulation would be that there could be some as-of-right zoning, meaning if you design a project and it fits within the zoning envelope and doesn't ask for a variance or break the height limit or the setbacks or anything like that, that project can be approved without having to go through the
public
excruciating
comment.
Process.
Got it.
I mean, often the actual process of entitlement takes 2 or 3 times as long as to physically build a building.
And we had a great piece on that on one of the projects that's going to be built in Mid-Market. It took 3 years to go through the process. There was no opposition. There was a year's wait to get a planner. Planners kind of poked it around for a year. Then the determination was it needed an EIR because it was on the edge of a possible historic district.
Environmental impact review?
Yes, environmental impact review. Nobody ever opposed that project, and it got a unanimous vote when it went through, and it took 3 years.
So you're saying even without a lot of public comment, it still takes too long, is your point there? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, mine just real quick would be it wouldn't be as easy to file environmental quality lawsuits as it is now. You know, maybe if you filed them and lost with that, and there was no cause to your suit, there'd be a financial penalty or something. Because those are often used just to slow down projects in the hope the project will collapse.
Right. Stanley, did you have more there that you were going to say? Okay. No. So in the last 5 or so minutes of the program, wanted to hear about some projects that we didn't talk about for 2017 that you're excited to see, or areas of the city that you anticipate are going to be the next hotbeds of building and construction. Lisa?
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, we have a project in Central Soma at the Bay Club site at 88 Bluxome. And the whole Central Soma is also undergoing zoning and planning changes.
And so if you could give us a definition of what you would say Central Soma is.
Central Soma is actually a really pretty large area, extending all the way from everything south of downtown out towards past Caltrain, and then out to Seventh Street. I'm talking more specifically, I think, about that western side, the western Central Soma, southwestern Central Soma, south of the Caltrain station and west of there. But the Flower Mart, for example, is a project which is getting completely redeveloped. There's a Michael Maltzen project happening there as well. There's just a lot of new density that's going to be created, as well as new community benefits like open space and things which will help break up the block structure, which is really huge right now, really long blocks without any kind of relief. There's going to be a new bike lane along Brannan where that's planned. So, you know, I think that area is going to be really pretty fascinating.
My two really quick. One would be to see the Salesforce Tower finished. I'm really curious what it'll be like when there are people inside it. As that any large building, you can't really judge it until it's an actual occupied functioning thing. The other thing I'm really interested this year, there are a number of housing buildings, multi-unit family housing projects that will be completed down in Dogpatch. And Dogpatch has kind of gone crazy in terms of being discovered and all. But there are a number of projects that are trying to add density there but still have that kind of raffish, hard-to-pin-down Dogpatch character. I'd be really curious to see what the neighborhood feels like with another 2,000 housing units layered in. And these buildings, I think probably half a dozen will be finished by the end of the year.
Stanley?
You know, the other area that I think has been transforming and is going to change in the next year is the mid-market area and the rehabbing of two historic buildings into new hotels, the infill buildings that are happening along Market Street, the project that John mentioned before, 1028 Market. So, you know, I think that's finally consolidating and really kind of sewing together downtown and sort of the midtown in a way that I think repairs a lost part of the city.
And speaking of which, adjacent to that is the Civic Center Plaza, which I understand the city is taking bids on redesigning. What do you know about that, John?
At this point, it's very much casting the net for landscape architecture, public process teams to enter, and then they'll kind of decide who should actually pursue the process. That is such a visible piece. I haven't seen the list yet. I'm going to be talking with the city this week. What I'm told is pretty much any landscape architect with any ambition at all would love to get that job. So I think it'll be an interesting tension where you're going to see a lot of creative people who want to come in and leave a mark in an area that has a very strong historic context and a very dense set of political and cultural and social watchdogs. So it's going to play out over the next 2 years or so.
All right. And we'll have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. I want to thank my guest, John King, urban design critic for the San Francisco Chronicle and also the author of the Cityscapes series, the most recent of which is Cityscapes 2, Reading the Architecture of San Francisco. Lisa Iwamoto, principal of Iwamoto Scott Architects and professor of architecture at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley, and Stanley Sadowitz, principal of Natoma Architects and emeritus professor at the College of Environmental Design at UC Berkeley. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks to all of you who listened. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week as we discuss San Francisco's future as a sanctuary city. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.